Alana sure has figured out that it is possible to have too much of a good thing.
I'm partnered with somebody who's also very into cars, which means that there is nobody in our family who's like, don't buy another car. So we have too many cars. People are gonna be like, you can't have too many cars. You can, we do. They're like kittens, man. They just come into your life and they need a new home. What are you gonna do?
Welcome to What Moves You, a Speedway Motors podcast where we tell the stories behind the cars and the people who build and drive them. I'm Joe McCullough, and in this episode, Alana Schur joins us to talk about how she finds and tells great car stories, how her position as senior features editor at Car and Driver gives her a unique perspective on cars both new and old, and her personal fleet that just seems to keep on growing. So I guess starting at the very beginning, how did you first get started with cars and doing car stuff?
Well, my very beginning is probably not as far back as most car people's very beginning because I did not grow up in a car family. I was not interested in cars as a kid, except, you know, maybe like DeLoreans or something, you know.
Right.
And I didn't even get a license as a teenager. So I didn't get a license until I was 21, at which point I kind of needed to buy a car before I could learn how to drive one because there wasn't any sort of family car that I could practice on. So I had a friend, a neighbor, who was willing to help me out, and he would test drive things for me. This is back when you could get a classic car for much less money than a used newer car. You know, there were still a lot of classic cars that were very, very affordable. And so he helped me test driving and helped me kind of looking at the mechanics of things. And I ended up buying a 73 Plymouth Duster. So it was very cute. It's triple white. I think it lives in Canada now. But so I bought the car. I didn't know how to drive it. Didn't have a license. My roommate used to have to move it for street cleaning day. And of course, I started having to fix things on it before I could even really drive it that much. I mean, it was a pretty good car. Like, it was in good shape. But, you know, like, starters like to go out and that kind of thing. And so right. I remember, you know, like, sometimes my neighbor would help me. We'd, like, get it up on the curb and change the starter, or somebody down the street once helped me because the there was like an ECU box on the side that was bad. And you know, it was funny because for the rest of the time that I owned that car, it had one metric bolt on it because that particular neighbor was a mechanic who worked on imported cars. So the only bolts that he had when we went to change this thing were metric. I don't know what happened to the original one, but so it was like that kind of thing, you know. It was like a real takes a village to teach someone how to learn about a car. But and a bunch of different people gave me driving practice too, which, you know, I think in the end was very helpful because I had different people would notice different things that I was doing wrong or have a different idea of how I should maybe try to fix them. And so I think that was, you know, in the long run, very helpful. So I eventually got a driver's license. And once I did, I was like, oh my God, this is the best. And in that whole time of learning about the car and keeping it running, I really kind of fell in love with the whole process of it. You know, like, what do things do? What is each part called? You know, why is this car cooler than that car? I was reading car magazines and going to Friday night car shows and stuff. And, I don't know. You know, sometimes you're a late bloomer, but then you really go for it all in.
So what were you doing then? Like, were you studying to do something else?
Oh yes, very much so. I was in college at the time. I was in the fine arts program at UCLA. I was planning on being like a gallery artist, like doing sculpture. There was no plan of racetracks and car magazines in my mind at that point.
So then when did you start writing?
I guess I've kind of always written. I've always been a really big reader. So, you know, I've always liked writing essays or writing emails or just every sort of opportunity that comes in life that involves writing. I mean, I used to have lots of pen pals and that kind of stuff. So telling stories via writing was not something that was particularly new to me. And I didn't have like an official double major or anything, but I did take a lot of literature classes and writing classes when I was in school. So I was aware that that was something that I might be also interested in, you know, sort of considered art criticism, that kind of stuff. So it wasn't, that part never seemed strange to me. It was just what I ended up writing about that was like, huh, okay.
So I feel like the first, certainly the first I heard of you was writing for Hot Rod, but you must have covered a lot of ground between changing the starter on a 73 Duster laying in the street to being on staff at Hot Rod magazine. How did that happen?
Oh, gosh. Well, so let's see. So I was in school. I had the Duster. I got rear-ended in the Duster, and I bought a 72 Challenger that I was like, oh, I'm going to build an engine for this, like engine swaps. That's a thing that people do. And, you know, at this point, I was really dedicating myself to learn, like kind of like a accelerated learning course on car stuff, in particular, like Mopar muscle cars. So, you know, I was reading Carcraft, I was reading Hot Rod, I was reading Mopar Muscle, Mopar Collector's Guide, like all of the car magazines, in particular, the like wrenching ones. And initially it was like, it was mostly like looking at the pictures, like a little kid reading grown-up books or something. Mm-hmm. And, but you know, it's like you keep reading and you keep talking to people and you keep doing things. And eventually all of those words start to mean something. And one day you're looking through the magazine, you're like, I understood all of that. So I was doing that. And at the same time, you know, I was meeting more people and I met some friends who were, you know, more into racing stuff. So I started going to the races, following drag racing and NASCAR, IndyCar, like, and when I met, he's now my husband, but, when I first started dating Tom, he took me to the drag races and like the local drag races and he let me drive his car. And I was like, ooh, I want to do this. This is great. So we raced a lot during that time. And work wise, you know, by then I was out of school. I worked for a sculptor for a long time doing mold making. And then when I got, you know, when I left that job, I ended up working in motorcycle racing. First sort of working in a shop where I did kind of like packaging and ordering parts and stuff like that. And then I worked for another motorcycle parts company that made carbon fiber bodywork for AMA racing and a little mm-hmm. bit for World GP. And, you know, so I was using like the art school stuff because we were doing mold making and layup and I was, you know, going to the races a lot and was into it. And I kept trying. At this point I had decided that working for a car magazine would be really fun. And I kept applying and just like nothing, crickets, like just no answers whatsoever. So, you know, I kept doing all of these things that were sort of alongside of what I wanted to be doing. And when I left the carbon fiber stuff, I got a job in PR, automotive aftermarket PR. So, you know, it was a similar skill set really to what I was doing at the end of the carbon job, which was a little bit more on the marketing side for the mm-hmm. company rather than doing layup anymore. And so then I got to meet all of the car people mm-hmm. at the magazines, including David Freiberger at Hot Rod. And so when they had an opening, it took a long time. Like, I think that job was open for like 6 months or something before I was brave enough to ask about it. And he was like, yeah, you should totally apply. So that was a very long story, but it was a long time. I mean, that was probably 10 years from when I got the license to when I finally got in at a car magazine. And, you know, a lot of people have to start much, much lower in their writing career than at Hot Rod magazine. I mean, I was pretty lucky to score a job with a byline at a real important title like that right away.
Do you remember the first time you saw one of your articles in print?
The very first time I saw one of my articles in print, I think it was in Mopar Collector's Guide, and I was super stoked about it, even though they had not paid me for it. but actually, that's not totally true, because when I was working PR, I would often see things that I had written in print, only you see them with somebody else's byline on them. So it was like thrilling, but also really disappointing. I think the first time that I saw something in print that I was truly proud of, it wasn't even in print, it was online. It was Bangshift. Brian Loans of Bangshift published a story I wrote about hanging out with a nostalgia Top Fuel team at Bakersfield. And I was pretty stoked. I felt like, you know, like people talk a lot about imposter syndrome. And I knew that I should be doing what I was doing, but it was really easy to get sidelined when people told you you shouldn't be. But that was like a moment where I was like, this is good. I wrote it and it's good and people like it.
So, I mean, and you have, so, I mean, people who listen to the podcast know that I have, like, I have loved Gray Baskerville since I was a little kid. And it was because you had lots of people who it seemed, you know, as a little kid, you know, like you said, you're kind of like looking at the pictures, you know, and then you would read the article and it's like, okay, this is a Mustang and it has a, you know, 351 and it's whatever. And that's what the article would tell you. And then here were these articles by this Gray Baskerville character. And it was like super lyrical and like just out of nowhere. And I feel like that was what, like, why I started recognizing your name in Hot Rod, because your articles seem to sort of have that quality of being like, it's just about a little bit more than just the car. And it's really great. And I think that that's probably what everybody loves about your writing. What would you say are the ingredients that make for a good automotive journalist?
Well, first of all, gratitude when you get compliments. So thank you for that. That was really nice. I think there are a lot of entry points into any kind of hobby, any kind of enthusiasm. And so this would apply beyond automotive journalism. You know, there are a lot of different ways of being good at it. There are people who are really great at describing the physical and technical characteristics of driving a car super fast. I remember, I think it was Kim Reynolds at Motor Trend, I always thought did great, great on-track stories. And I think that that's a very valuable thing. There are people who are like excellent at breaking down very complicated technical specifications and making it possible to understand them without engineering degrees. And that is also incredibly valuable. You know, and then there's stuff where, you know, it's like, can you talk to other people? Because a lot of people forget, especially when thinking about something like automotive, that like a car does not make itself and a car does not exist separated from the people who did make it. I think that hot rodders understand this maybe better than new car people because, you know, they tend to go to a show and they meet the guy or the girl who built it, or they have a friend who's building one. So they know that like the end decisions made in a car represent the person who built it and the people who worked on it. So for me, starting at Hot Rod, it was pretty easy for me to understand the importance of people in a story about a car. And all of that applies to new car stuff too, which is, you know, more of what I'm doing now at Car and Driver. You know, there's still a bunch of people, a whole team of people involved in deciding a car. And, you know, sometimes decisions are as simple as like the one guy in charge of steering wheels liked this wheel design, you know, and like fought for it or whatever. And it's like, well, why? And then you like talk to him and it's like, cause it reminds them of this, like, you know, I don't know, AMC that he's dad had or something like that. So I think that a sort of curiosity as to why people are building what they're building is maybe important across the board, whether you plan to be a technical writer or you want to be a more lyrical writer or an adventure writer. You know, you need to want to know why people made those choices.
So you mentioned you're now senior features editor, right, at Car and Driver. And it seems like in the past, again, you know, reading car magazines as a little kid, there was some sort of animosity amongst the like Hot Rod and Car Craft guys about the Clean Hands car magazines, where like all they do is drive around in these new cars. How did you make that transition from Hot Rod to now Car and Driver?
Well, I mean, it wasn't like an immediate, you know, swap over, because I did some years in freelance where I did both old car and new car stories. And I mean, Car and Driver has been very nice to me in that they've let me continue to pursue some old car stories at, you know, at CD as well. I think that, you know, there's these real waves to car magazine history, especially the titles that have been around for a really long time. And if you're like a deep, deep nerd fan and you read all the way back and then all the way through, you kind of see that, oh, well, like this group was really into expanding the coverage and this group was like very strict about only covering this kind of car. And, you know, this group was into everything again. And so there are eras of Car and Driver or Road and Track that I like better than some eras of Hot Rod or Car Craft. There are also eras of Car Craft and Hot Rod, which I like much better than eras of Car Driver and Road and Track, that kind of thing. Currently, I think that, like, sort of across the board, boundaries are less strict than they were even when I started. I mean, I don't know if you guys are finding that in what people call ordering parts for, how many different projects they have. But I feel like when I started getting into cars, people were very brand loyal and they were like very nationalistic, right? Like, it's like, are you a German car person? Are you an American car person? Are you a Japanese car person? Are you, do you like Volvos? You know, it's like you were only going to have that thing, you know, maybe you have a Ford and a Dodge, but probably not even that. And I think that now, maybe because of the internet and how many different cool car videos and car like ways of finding neat cars there are, I think people have really expanded. I'm guessing that in, you know, previously you would basically, like I did, you would learn about cars from someone who liked cars. So I got into Chrysler stuff, not because I like sought it out initially. I mean, originally they all looked pretty much the same to me. You know, I didn't know a Nova from a Duster, but I had a friend who was into Chryslers. His friends were all into Chryslers. So when I started learning, that's what I was learning about. And I think that's the way that it used to be a lot, you know, like you learn from your uncle or you learn from a neighbor, or, you know, your mom always drove Plymouths, whatever. You know, a lot of the sort of Michigan people would have families who worked for the car companies. And it was like, you didn't work at different car companies, you know, like everybody in the family worked for the same one. So I think that with as many ways as there are now of like going online and being like, oh my gosh, have you seen like this cool little vintage Subaru? I really want one of those. Or, you know, like, oh my gosh, a Messerschmitt, like a, you know, like whatever. It's like there's just like more ways to see cool stuff. And so I think that people are a little bit more forgiving across the board on it when people like different things, which is to say I haven't had any real problem transitioning from Hot Rod to Car and Driver.
That is absolutely something that I have noticed. And I've never really attributed it to the internet and the fact that you can just go and look at everything all the time. I've always thought it was because it's almost, you know, us versus them used to be the Mopar guys hate the Chevy guys and the, you know, like you're talking about. But now the us versus them is almost people who love cars and driving cars and people who just don't give a toot, you know. And so the people who love cars are sort of like, that guy who likes a Porsche is okay with me, you know, because at least he likes it. And we, you know, we sort of speak the same language, you know.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's like, you know, if you're into cars, you'd rather, you know, you'd rather hang out with a bunch of people who have classic alphas, even if you're into Camaros, than you would hang out with a bunch of people who like are into, you know, carbon fiber bicycles or something like that.
You are in a unique position to, you know and love old cars, but then you get to like drive around in all of these new cars all the time. How has that changed your perception? Like, you know, driving around in a new car, how does that make you feel about driving around in your old car and then vice versa?
I will tell you that there is only one thing that new cars truly have over old cars or over my old cars, and that is air conditioning. It's been 110 for the last 4 days here. I don't have a current press car. And yeah, I think that there was an actual sizzling sound when I went to put my seatbelt on today in the Trans Am. So I do miss that. There are some things that I like about new cars, especially if you're going on a long trip, you know, some of the newer technology, especially like connectivity to a phone, and, you know, it's much easier to be able to like look at the map on the screen and figure out where you're going in a new and unfamiliar place. But, when it all really comes down to it, they all kind of do the same things. And, you know, I don't have too much trouble bouncing back and forth between them. You know, every once in a while you have to be like, okay, I was just in like a 911. My 78 Dodge is not going to stop that fast. So do not take this freeway exit the exact same way. But you figure that out really quickly. So you're not going to like forget.
And I mean, that is something do you still daily your old cars?
Yeah, I do. We still don't own anything that's newer than 93. And that's the Cummins turbo diesel truck, which Tom drives usually as a daily. So, I mean, I do have many more new cars coming in and out, and I'm also traveling a lot. So I'm not driving nearly as much as I used to be. I mean, I used to commute down to El Segundo when I was at Hot Rod, and, you know, I would do that with Brandon Galogli, who's now at Hagerty. I had a Challenger. We would also take the Polara, or when I got the Opel, we would take the Opel. So, but these days I've been going back and forth between the Opel GT and the Trans Am most of the time when it's my own drive.
So the Challenger and your sort of personal fleet, the Challenger was the first thing after the Duster.
Mm-hmm.
And that you still have.
Yes. I don't have the first Challenger.
Oh, okay.
I had a 72, and then, we got a 70. And so I sold the 72 because, I mean, how many Challengers does one person need? It's just greedy.
Well, so then the Opel, and so then the Polara sort of makes sense, right? It's a Mopar. It's a practical big Mopar that you can haul stuff in. Was that kind of the logic there?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I would say, first of all, that if you are going to ask me for logic in any of these car decisions, we should just start over, go a different direction.
Just hang up the phone.
Yeah, just, I gotta go. You know, so I guess, first of all, you know, I'm partnered with somebody who's also very into cars, which means that there is nobody in our family who's like, don't buy another car, you know? So we have too many cars. Just like people are gonna be like, you can't have too many cars. You can, we do. But sometimes it was just like they're like kittens, man. They just come into your life and they need a new home. What are you gonna do?
And so I'm beating around the bush here to try to get to the Opel, because that is like one of these things is not like the other. And an Opel is kind of gonna be that way in any garage. Where did that thing come from?
So that one is actually pretty easy to explain. We had a neighbor who was visiting from Hungary, I think. And he was flipping cars. He was buying cars here. They were shipping them back, and he was selling them there. And they had found an Opel GT. I was going for a walk. I saw it in the yard. I went running over. I was like, what is this? It's the cutest thing I've ever seen. I need one. And so I didn't buy that one, but about 3 years later, I bought the one that I have.
We posted to our social media some time back an Opel GT that somebody had, I don't know, it was like an LS swap or something, Opel GT that was kind of within our wheelhouse. And immediately a whole bunch of people tagged you in the post. So, so you are like, now, how does it feel to be equated as like the Opel GT expert?
I love it. I don't deserve the honor. There are Opel people who know so much more. But I am an unrelenting cheerleader for the Opel GT. I really think it is a fantastic car, massively underrated in how fun it is and not that hard to work on. Mine has actually been, granted, I am lucky because I live with a mechanic. And so, you know, he helps me take care of things. We generally keep things running pretty well, but the Opel has given me very little trouble. It has never come home on a trailer, knock on wood. And, in all the time that I've had it, which now is more than 10 years, and it's only needed rescue, I think, twice. Once because a linkage came apart, so somebody brought me a wrench and I was able to fix mm-hmm. it on the road. And once because I blew a fuse, and so basically somebody came down with some wiring and right. wired us back up, and we were able to flip the lights back on and get home. So yeah, it's a, you know, it's a real champ, and it's a lot of fun.
That is, of course, the one that you would expect to be super unreliable and like just constantly causing you grief.
Yeah, I know they have a really bad rep, and I have a theory on it, which is that, you know, that was during that time period where a lot of the American car companies were bringing in one subcompact made somewhere else, you know?
Right.
And so the Opel was brought in by Buick and sold initially as a Buick, which meant that if you bought one and you had a problem with it, you went to a Buick dealership. And can you imagine being like a Buick mechanic in 1970 and having to work on an Opel GT when you're used to working on Skylarks or whatever? I just think that the mechanics were probably like, you know, not interested. It's weird. Right. Don't like it. And then, you know, they're also, you know, they're not like super thick steel or anything like that. They rusted a lot. And little mm-hmm. cars, and anybody out there who's like a little car collector, I bet you guys can relate to this. So big cars, if you don't want them, you tend to get rid of them because you don't have the space to store them. But little cars, you right. can shove behind a like shed somewhere, or like behind the garage, or just like leave in a corner of a yard and under a tarp and forget about them. And that's why they all rot so badly, because they, you know, like all the Fiats and Opals and everything else, they've just been sitting outside because mm-hmm. nobody needs that space because they don't take up that much space. Anyway. It's my theory. I'm sticking to it.
I have never thought of it that way before. I have noticed that Mopar people tend to have lots of like cars and partial cars laying around, like maybe more than other people. But I don't know if there's.
I would argue, but I cannot.
So talking about the date, like that is something that sort of, you know, looking at your social media and whatever, like. The fact that you are committed to daily driving these old cars, you know, I have done it before, but I have never done it for long because it kind of beats you down. Like it's constant work and maintenance that like reaches a point where, for me anyway, it sort of took some of the joy out of driving an old car and just made it sort of feel like a drag. And I hated that. And so I had to go buy some, you know, fuel injected reliable thing that was soulless, but I could forget about. Have you had that experience? Have you ever been like, oh my God, I'm just done with this?
Only recently, and only because the weather has been so bad. And by recently, I mean, maybe in the last couple of years, that the weather has been so bad and the traffic in Los Angeles has gotten so much worse. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, most of the time it's fine, but you know, it used to be when I first started, if you hit a traffic jam, maybe you were stopped for 5-10 minutes and then you could keep moving. But now it's like a drive will be like an hour plus of just creeping. And mm-hmm. you know, my stuff runs really well, but it's uncomfortable for the car and for me to be sitting and, you know, not moving. And so every once in a while, I'm like, you know, I don't know about this. But that's why right now everything, you know, it's a kind of a perfect setup, because half the time I've got a new car. And also, I never leave the house anymore, you know. I mean, we're mm-hmm. all just like working from home. But I do have some suggestions for people who do want to try daily driving classics. Well, first of all, is Marry a Mechanic. That's the best one. But but I mean, like, all joking aside, you know, you do have to be comfortable and have a space that you can work on to make it viable. You know, I mean, without Tom's help, I would not have nearly so many cars. But I did drive classic cars for 2 or 3 years before, you know, before I met him, and I was able to keep them running because I did have a space to work on them, and I had some other friends who could help me mm-hmm. when I hit something that I didn't understand. But I think I'm not following this advice, but having two classic cars is better than having one, Because sometimes you have a mechanical issue that can't be fixed in an afternoon. And it's very nice to be able to say like, okay, I will work on this over the weekend and I will drive this other car for the week until I get this one fixed or until this part mm-hmm. comes in that's on back order or whatever. When you have one car and that car is a classic, you really got to get it running again so that you can get to work or whatever. And that can be stressful. But if you have two, as long as you're kind of strict with yourself, you know, you can't sort of set them aside and be like, I'll deal with this later, because you never will. And then eventually it's just a place where spiders live.
For pictures of Alana and her cars, check out the toolbox at speedwaymotors.com by clicking the toolbox link on the front page. Check out Alana's YouTube channel called Challenge Her and read about her adventures in Car and Driver. New episodes of What Moves You come out every 2 weeks on Tuesdays. If you like what you hear, tell a friend to listen to What Moves You on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and anywhere else you listen to podcasts. So, you know, we're talking about this sort of new versus old thing. And, you know, in a lot of these conversations, the elephant in the room is the EV thing. And I suspect that you, in your position, have a lot more experience with EVs than maybe a lot of our listeners, you know, who are, if you can't change the jets in it, they don't know what to do with it. And I'm one of them. You know, I've never been in or driven one. So what do you think as an old car person, you know, what do you think of the way things seem to be going?
Well, first of all, I'm always surprised who has sort of like a secret EV knowledge, even amongst old car enthusiasts. Mm-hmm. I've met a huge amount of people where they are into old cars and maybe their spouse has an EV because they are not into old cars, and it's like a really good combo. Mm-hmm. You know, the other day I was doing a story about doing an EV road trip, and I met a couple who have an airplane. They fly a Cessna. Their garage is a hangar that like leads out onto a private airstrip. It is the life. Wow. But they have a Cessna, and they have they have EVs because they were like, oh, it's, you know, we feel like it's a nice balance of what we're, you know, where we're using our carbon credits.
Right.
You know, so there's no reason that it really has to be like a this or that situation, you know, for people. I have got to drive a lot of EVs. They're very, very fast now, which, you know, is something that could win over a lot of folks who previously liked gas engine cars because mm-hmm. of performance. There is work to be done if the future is truly to be all EV. Mm-hmm. The charging networks outside of simply charging it at your home are not always super reliable. It's definitely not as easy as like filling up a gas car.
Right.
But, you know, there are things that are nice about them. They're, you know, if you don't want a loud car, it is kind of amazing how quiet they are, you know, like, that is not something that I've ever really sought out in,
right.
in car ownership, but I do understand that a lot of people, you know, maybe they either have more sensitive hearing or they just don't like a constant, you know, distraction. And so the mm-hmm. EVs are quieter. They're very fast. They're interesting. You know, I think that there's a real appeal to exploring new technology simply to understand it. You know, it's all new language, whole new kind of nerddom for people.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Know? So if, you know, I got nothing against them. I'm not currently shopping for one personally. I've yet to drive one that I want in my own driveway permanently.
Okay.
But I totally enjoy them as as sort of a temporary adventure. And I could easily see how somebody might want to have a household that had one EV and one classic, because it would be a good combo.
I'm interested because that's the thing that everybody says. Everybody who is sort of an early adopter is like, you know, say what you want to, but you know, it's fast. I mean, what a lot of stock EVs just off the showroom floor run 11 second quarters or better. What talk about the experience of driving something like that versus something, I don't know, like a 1LE Camaro or a Hellcat or something like that, where it's like the sort of the same speed, but being manufactured completely differently.
Oh my God, it is totally not as good. I'm sorry. It is not as good. I will be accused of cave womanhood, but like, there's almost no sense of how fast you're going, because like with a gas engine or a diesel engine, you know, it makes more and angrier noises the faster you're going, until it gets to this point where you're like, it's making unhappy noises and we must be going very fast, right? You know, like it's screaming. EVs, even the ones that do have sound, and they're working on various different performance sounds and stuff, it feels like the Star Wars ride at Disneyland or something like that, or like Space Mountain, you know, where it's like, you know, you're going fast. It's not, it's thrilling. It's not boring. It's just, it is not as good at all. Like, I mean, on a pure excitement level, I would say that driving a stick shift muscle car that makes 300, 400 horsepower would be more exciting all the time, except maybe a land speed run, than driving any of the EVs, even the like 2000 horsepower ones.
What about EV swaps into an old car? Are you there yet?
Again, I'm not interested in EV swapping into an old car. I mean, it's funny because I was just having this conversation with a friend of mine, which is, with all respect to the artistry and to the reasons why people like them, I don't even really like restomods more than just a nice performance rebuild of a stock-ish setup. Mm-hmm. I enjoy all of the personality of old cars, including the wonky bits. Mm-hmm. And I feel a little bit like doing these swaps for me is like taking somebody who you really like and being like, okay, well, if I just this one silly eyebrow, if I like fix that, and like if I, you know, if you like don't have that freckle that's strange, and the one crooked tooth. And the next thing you know, they just kind of look like a, you know, like not a real person anymore or something.
Right.
So, you know, but that's 100% just a personal, like, what would I do to my own garage?
Right.
I think that EV swaps in the hobby are great, because anything that would make someone drive an old car rather than keep an old car in their garage not driving is super fine with me. Anything. Right. Like, go for it. Do it, just as long as you get that thing out and you move it around. Of course, if I like, you know, if I run into like a Lamborghini Mira where somebody took the Lambo engine out and put in an electric car, motor, I'm going to be like, really, man, really? Especially because now everybody could just buy, like, get like a carbon fiber body and do whatever swap you want with it.
Right. I have said that before. Like, even long before the whole EV swap thing was a thing, even a muscle car where you put a modern fuel injected engine in it and a, you know, 8-speed automatic transmission and nice coilovers and stuff, it's kind of not the same car anymore. And it's kind of, I have asked myself that before, like, what's the point of having a Challenger where you've done that when you could just go buy a new Challenger and it's going to do all of that stuff better? You know, I sort of prefer to have the vinyl seats that are going to burn your butt when you sit down, and the carburetor that you have to pump three times and know just the right combination to get it to fire on a cold morning. That's what makes it an old car. And so it's interesting for me to hear you say that too.
Yeah. And like I said, I totally understand why people want to do, you know, more extreme swaps. And I am very much not a keep it stock person, you know, like I'm like, oh yeah, I'm putting leather in this car. And, you know, do I want fuel injection? Maybe I'll put fuel injection on this engine, or, you know, I got no problem with any of that. I feel like there is something to kind of the way that it started out, where when you do like a complete transplant, you're like, is this the same car?
Yeah.
Is it just a not as good new car?
So I feel like this could be either a very simple or a very complicated question. What's your favorite car you've ever driven?
Okay, there's probably a couple of them. So I would really, really like a last gen Viper. I loved the way that I felt in that car. That car had old car personality and new car convenience. Mm-hmm. And it was a magical combination. Plus, I never got tired of looking at it. Wherever I parked, I would just yeah, that's my baby right there. So that car was pretty spectacular. And, you know, I mean, I'm pretty fond of all of my cars. You know, I still have a 70 Challenger. That's a pretty special car to drive. Mm-hmm. Feel pretty wonderful in it. My husband has a 69 Charger RT.
Oh, wow.
And that car makes you feel like you're the most famous movie star ever, but also a villain, which is a real good combo. Right. So that one's pretty fun to drive as well. You know, and there's a lot of great new cars. Like the Caymans, I like the Lotus Evora a lot. It just had a nice drive down Highway 1 in a Mercedes SL. Everything's good.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow. It doesn't get a whole lot better than that.
Yeah, I did get a speeding ticket, so.
Really? In the Mercedes?
Yeah.
Well, and that's not like an outrageously fast car either, right?
It's pretty fast. The new one's fast.
Oh, okay. What are you have a current project, right? Like you have a new project in your fleet, right? The Nova.
Yes.
How did that come about?
So, like I said, cars just find us, and we have nobody in our household who says no. So, we were actually talking about needing to sell a car, and then somehow that conversation turned into Tom being like, "Oh, my nephew is selling his Nova," and I was like, "What Nova?" And he's like, "You remember the one he bought like 10 years ago and took apart and never put together?" And I was like, "Oh, what year is that?" And he's like, "That's a 70 SS, like 4-speed. And I was like, "Oh, that would be fun to put together. You know, that shouldn't be too hard." And so, you know, next thing we know, we're like carting this thing home on a trailer, a bunch of milk crates full of parts. It's like, what is the one rule, dude? What is the one rule? Like, do not buy someone's taken apart project.
Right.
Yeah. Well, that rule still applies, even if it is your nephew, because there's all kinds of missing parts and, you know, we've already gone, you know, beyond what we intended to in getting it repainted and all of this stuff. But it's fun. I've never built a Nova before, so it's all like a bunch of learning new stuff. And I'm really happy with the color that we painted. It looks great. So mm-hmm. It's going to be fun to put together, fun to do some burnouts in it, and then maybe hopefully send it on to a new home.
Oh, okay. Is that really going to happen?
I hope so. We'll find out.
Okay, I'm going to jump around here. I have to ask, what is your favorite story you've ever covered?
Oh, gosh. Oh, man, that is such a hard question. So one story that was very special to me and is still very special to me was very early at Hot Rod, I got to go to Pikes Peak and I covered the classic, went back when there was a classic class that ran, and I covered mm-hmm. this guy named Jess Neal, who was running in a Barracuda 71 Cuda, and he ended up winning his class. And so that was like, I think the story is still good, but also it was a really big deal for me. You know, it was like an unsupervised, fairly complicated story that involved using like all the skills that we talked about, right? Like I had to have race knowledge. I had to have tech knowledge. I had to figure out where I needed to be and when. And I had to be socially adept enough that people who I had never met before would trust me and want to work with me. And we're still friends. So mm-hmm. that one worked out well. You know, so I loved that story. I've worked a lot with Don Prudhomme. That has obviously been incredible. You know, we wrote a book together. Mm-hmm. So. Mm-hmm. That was probably my largest and most difficult accomplishment. He was great, you know, but writing a book is is, boy, it's a big thing. Mm-hmm. I did a story for Automobile Magazine about learning how to go fish with Bobby Allison that I'm very, very fond of. You know, that was another one where kind of, it's not like the usual ask. There's no PR person who sends you a note that's like, do you want to go fishing with NASCAR legend Bobby Allison, right? So, you know, you really have to do that stuff. And then I loved, like, when Viper came out, I did a road trip in an ACR where with Larry Chen, who's a wonderful photographer, and I slept on the wing, which, you know, like, I was doing the story was basically like, I want this car so much I would sell everything I own for it, but then I would have to live in it. And is that possible?
Right.
For the most part, it's been either road trips or motorsports.
And that was actually something else I was going to ask you about. You know, we talk about the people and the stories, but do you feel, you know, you go to lots of famous places, right? I mean, Pikes Peak, Baja, you know, all the famous drag strips. Like, do you feel that sort of sense of place and sort of the ghosts when you're there? And like, does that impact what you write about how you cover the event?
Oh, for sure. I mean, I'm big on feeling vibes, but I would say the number one place where you feel that stuff, or there's probably two places. Bonneville, the Salt Flats, is probably the most ghost haunted by motorsports history place.
I got goosebumps when you said
that. Like, that place is, I got goosebumps talking about it. Every time I go, I mean, I have cried there before just from, like, it's so amazing. Just the place is so amazing. And then Indianapolis, both the speedway and the drag strip, those mm-hmm. feel really steeped in, like, a thrilling, thrilling history.
Mm-hmm. So what do you see your job looking like in the future, near and far?
Well, you know, I'm always just like waking up every day, like, are they still going to let me do this? Like,
oh, I know the feeling.
That I'm having too much fun and they shouldn't pay me anymore. You know, I mean, I think that, you know, Car and Driver has a sort of reliable cadence to what they're working on. So, I mean, clearly we're going to be, you know, we're going to be learning more about electric cars, unless, you know, something crazy happens. I don't know. Like, what if there's some sort of, like, what are those, like, electrical EV bombs that they're always worried about?
Oh, yeah.
You know, but I think that's unlikely. So I think we're going to be learning a lot more about EVs. So that's a lot of technology to kind of stay brushed up on, a lot of, like, specs to learn. You know, I think we're going to probably put a charger in at the house here so that I can have a little bit more of a natural experience. Right now, whenever I have one to test, it's kind of like pain because there's not really a charger near my neighborhood. You know, and then we're going to, you know, we're going to see a lot of outgoing gas performance models. So that should be bittersweet, but like exciting, right? You know, because everyone's going to outdo themselves for like what is going to be the most, you know, the most Hellcat-y, Shelby'd, you know, AMG'd possible version that they could ever do. And then Car and Driver's been great because they've let me do a lot of people stories as well. And, you know, like, I just got to drive Ralph Gilles, speaking of carbon fiber, and Restomods, and it was a wonderful car. So, like, I would not kick it out of my driveway, even though it doesn't have a 440 in it. You know, so we just did an interview and a story with him, and I've got to do a couple of sort of road trip stories. There's some other stuff that we're working on as well. So I'm hoping that I get to sort of do a balance of those kind of, you know, new car reviews and learning and tech explainers, but also kind of sneak in some of what I love, which is, as you pointed out, kind of the culture and the interaction with the humans who make the cars.
Thanks to Alana Scher for being our guest today, and thanks to all of you for listening to What Moves You, a Speedway Motors podcast. To see photos and watch video we referenced in today's episode, visit the toolbox at speedwaymotors.com. Email the podcast at podcast@speedwaymotors.com, and if you like what you heard, tell a friend where to find us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.